freight efficiency with NACFI's Mike Rosenfrenz.
Here in episode 90, we're joined by Amory Lovins. He's co-founder and chairman emeritus of RMI, where we talk about why he thinks we have only scratched the surface of how much efficiency is available and worth buying. He also talks about the importance of integrative design and the role of both equipment and drivers in improving efficiency. We also talk about how he views various alternatives to diesel in powering trucks. Finally, we discuss how NACFI was founded back in 2009 and the difference the group has been making since.
Today we have joining us Amory Lovins, who is co-founder and chairman emeritus of RMI. I'm excited to have you on today, Amory. It's been a little while since we've talked. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, great to be here and to join this wonderful community that you've helped assemble.
Hey, I don't want to miss this first part. We titled this Freight Efficiency with NACFI's Mike Rosenfrenz. So you can't be on the podcast, Amory, without answering the question. Do you remember how we became friends or about the time and what caused us to become friends?
Good Lord. Well, I should, but I don't. So remind me.
You know, it happened after, I'm pretty sure it was after the charrette that started NACFI. And I've been wanting to have you on this podcast. I actually delayed having you on until now because this month is the 15th anniversary of that charrette. So I'm pretty sure, Amory, it happened just after that.
I think so. Yeah, half time flies when you're having fun. But I was really impressed with your leadership and the community you helped us assemble to figure out what to do about trucking and how to make it much more efficient and economical and clean. And I'm so impressed with the progress that the organization's made since then.
Yeah, it's been really fun being, you know, part of RMI and that whole piece. I mean, we'll get into Rocky Mountain Institute here in a minute, but we looked back at that charrette, and I had not looked back at it in some years. And there were three ideas that came out of the charrette people took on and made happen. You know, sometimes we go to finish these workshops, and we conclude it was somebody ought to do this and somebody ought to do that, and little gets done. But one of the three was NACFI, just an unbiased third party. And then it surprised me because, Amory, I looked at the third one was to build demonstration vehicles that could prove, that this was real world and happened. And that's what we've done with Run On Less. So, yeah, feels really good.
Well, DOE has done a lot of that. The OEMs have been quite impressive. We put out a paper in 2008 at RMI saying you could double or triple Class 8 truck efficiency without compromise. And from 2005 to 15, roughly, we helped Walmart double the efficiency of their fleet with great contributions from the various vendors. I think it's pretty clear now that you can do a factor 3 or probably 4 compared with the Ought 5 fleet with a diesel powertrain. And I believe the best electric powertrain comes in at a factor 3 to 6 better, with, of course, somewhat lighter weight and much better aero, about 40% better. If you depending on the test conditions.
So, yeah, it is pretty extraordinary what the industry's done. I mean, we dealt with NOx and particulate matter along with the EPA rules, and then with carbon and greenhouse gas, and, you know, the Super Truck 2 DOE program just finished, and, you know, a couple manufacturers there, although they were measuring it in ton mile per gallon, which they should, but keeping in the legal 80,000 pounds, they're pushing 16 mile per gallon on a normal sort of duty cycle. So this point of efficiency, you know, and most particularly energy efficiency, I mean, that's kind of your thing, isn't it? I mean, how did that come about? I mean, what caused you to focus on it, and then, you know, even create Rocky Mountain Institute to have a, you know, an organization to focus there?
Well, I'm originally a recovering experimental physicist, and realized early on that energy, and especially its efficient use, was a kind of master key for unlocking the related puzzles of energy, resources, security, environment, development, and economy. So I decided to work on that for my life, and it's going pretty well. You know, the U.S. is now using about 64% less total energy per dollar of GDP than it would have if we were still as inefficient as we were in 1975. And yet we've just scratched the surface of how much efficiency is available and worth buying. And that resource keeps expanding. For example, it's now about twice as big as I suggested in our Reinventing Fire book in 2011, and it costs only a third as much. And that's now looking conservative because what I call integrative design, optimizing whole systems for multiple benefits, it turns out to make the energy efficiency resource several fold bigger than had been thought, and yet cheaper, and often with increasing returns like renewables, so that the more efficiency you buy, the cheaper it gets.
But why, Amory, and you, I think I've talked about this, why is it so, like, unpopular? I mean, is it just that it's not, you know, doing more with less seems so logical, but it's just not the sexy, shiny thing, you know? I mean, and like right now, you know, the electric truck gets so much attention, hydrogen gets a lot of attention, but yet here we are, as we've been talking about with, you know, I don't know, maybe not completely low-hanging fruit, but things that we can do to really make just simple things, direct things, incremental things. Why does that not happen?
Actually, think of it. Well, it is happening a couple of percent a year, sometimes much more. But we don't notice. You see, the energy is invisible, and the energy you don't use is almost unimaginable. So it's not surprising that the extraordinary progress with renewables, 95-odd% of the new capacity going in, it gets the headlines because you can see them on the rooftop, on the skyline. But the efficiency is invisible. It only shows up in your bottom line or perhaps in better range or other operational parameters that are hidden in a spreadsheet somewhere. And it's funny how this is really a cultural issue. I was working with a very large operator at a time when the diesel price suddenly doubled. So I called them up and said, how much slower are you asking your drivers to drive? They said, huh? I said, well, 2/3 of your fuel consumption is air resistance at highway speed. And it goes as the cube of speed. So shouldn't they drive slower when the fuel gets costlier? And they said, well, yeah, but our drivers are used to driving at a particular speed. It would be hard to change that. I said, yeah, I recognize there's all kinds of scheduling and demurrage and so on, complexities in the analysis, but shouldn't you do a little calc on what it's worth and see the size of the prize? And they did, and it was an extremely large number. Just to go a little bit slower, they'd save a huge amount of money, and yet they thought it was too culturally difficult to tackle.
And we travel in our motorhome quite a lot, so I got real world experience in speed and fuel cost, and actually, you know, the slower you go to, if you can, I mean, we've got freight to move, and there's some challenges, but the slower you go, the safer it is, and the less physically draining it is to drive the truck. It's a there's a lot of benefits to doing that.
Yeah, and driver fatigue is important to driver retention as well as safety.
So sometimes I hearken back to, you know, the oil crisis in the 70s. It sounds like some of your work coincided with that, and I even saw a picture of you with President Carter in the Oval Office as a young man. So, like, is that part of this, like, story of how, you know, your life and your career kind of timed with some of that experience to move into to what you did in starting Rocky Mountain Institute as well.
Yeah, very much so. You see, in the early 70s, before the Arab oil embargo broke on the world like a thunderclap in 73, and then followed by the bigger price rise in the Iranian Revolution in 79, in those days, there was no place you could go to study energy policy. And therefore, I didn't know how it was supposed to be done. So when I turned my attention to efficient use, which was just starting to be recognized a little bit, but you know, so a lot of our major energy experts and economists especially said, oh, you can't do energy efficiency because we're in a market economy, so we're already perfectly efficient. They really said stuff like that. In those days, you know, I didn't know better. And therefore, instead of extrapolating demand and building supply to meet it, I started at the other end. I asked, what do we want energy for? Stuff like ton miles moved and hot showers and cold beer and smelted aluminum and baked bread. What's the end use? And for each of those tasks, what's the cheapest way to do the job? That was a revolution. I was asking a different question. That's the hard part. And then, of course, you get a different answer. You discover that when you let efficient use compete with supply, you probably use a lot less, much more productively. And that changed everything. So I was lucky enough to get a paper into the Journal of Foreign Affairs, kind of in the bosom of the establishment, called Energy Strategy, The Road Not Taken, in 76. And that set off a furious debate. There was a 10-centimeter thick fine print congressional hearing record we call the paperweight of three dozen tedious responses to fatuous critiques, with experts saying, if you try to save energy and decouple energy growth from GDP growth, we'll be back to caves and candles. They really said this. But after about a year, Dave Sternlight, who ran strategy for ARCO, Atlantic Richfield, made a remark, got noticed, something like, well, I for one don't care if Lovins is only half right. That would be better performance than I've seen from the rest of them. And that kind of stopped the debate, and a lot of the companies that had been our severest critics started hiring us to help them do efficiency of renewables.
Yeah.
We've been really busy ever since.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about RMI, and, you know, well, I don't know. We can spend hours talking, but like, just distill it down to sort of like, what's your couple of, you know, when you look back, just what's your couple of real exciting things that, you know, we've made a difference at RMI?
Well, RMI is an independent nonprofit group and now active worldwide. The majority of our work is outside the U.S. and you have almost 800 people. Happy I don't have to run it anymore. Very good people at that. And I'm most pleased by a lot of our work with the private sector across all sectors and uses in the economy, pretty much, helping them use their unique skills to speed the energy transition and make a clean, prosperous, secure energy system for all, forever.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it has to do with just a culture of asking those questions, those different questions, those like end use questions, like you mentioned, and then, you know, constantly wanting to return to data. I mean, now big data and analyses and all of that sort of seems to be, I don't know, more in vogue because we have access to the data, but it's been clearly a tenet of what we've done at our Rocky Mountain Institute forever.
Yeah, so as your community works on efficient trucks, that's just one of many applications of some basic principles that Joel Swisher and I teach at Stanford And it's remarkable what you can do with whole system design. For example, I'm talking to you from my 40-odd-year-old house, jungle, and research center where we hatched RMI the first 18 years. And we've harvested our 81st passive solar banana crop inside, but we live at 7,100 feet up in the Rockies where it used to go as low as minus 47F. We've had 39 days of continuous midwinter cloud, but there's no heating system. And it was cheaper to build that way because the stuff we bought to get rid of the heating system cost less than we saved up front by leaving out the heating system. So we optimized the house as a system, not the insulation or the windows as a component. And my car is another example of that. I drive a BMW i3. It's half made of carbon fiber, makes it about 300 kilograms lighter. And carbon fiber was thought to be hopelessly expensive, but it turned out the car costs the same, and you buy it by the car, not by the pound. The reason it costs the same is you need a lot fewer batteries for the same range because you're moving less weight around. And it's also radically simpler to manufacture the car because you need a third the normal investment and water at half the normal energy, space, and time. Those things pay for the carbon fiber. So they sold a $250,000 very profitably. Another example from industry, which applies also to auxiliaries and trucks. Half the world's electricity runs motors. Half the motor torque runs pumps and fans. But people don't pay enough attention to the pipes and ducts coming out of the pumps and fans. The friction, say in a pipe, goes down as nearly the fifth power of diameter. So a slightly fatter pipe has much less friction, and yet its cost goes up as only the second power of diameter. So if you optimize the pipe as a component, you pessimize the system. So what we end up doing by optimizing the whole system is to use fat, short, straight pipes instead of skinny, long, crooked pipes. Same for ducts. And we lay out the pipes and ducts first, then the equipment to help make them straight and get rid of the elbows. Well, if everybody did this, it would save about a fifth of the world's electricity or half the coal-fired electricity. You get your money back instantly in new build or in less than a year, typically, in retrofit. And we can apply exactly the same principles to fluid handling in trucks.
You know, with our communication we had today, we worked in, you know, out from our homes during the pandemic. We can literally meet with anybody globally that cares about what we do through, you know, things like LinkedIn and other tools. So are those helpful in this systems thinking and in solving some of our problems that need to be urgent?
I'm aiming to put my Stanford lectures up on the web. They're already internally available to, I believe, about 3,000 higher ed technical institutes across India since I did a Teach the Teacher session in Chennai last fall. I'm about to do one in Australia, then one in Sweden and one in Germany, because we're trying to seed the spread of this design method so everybody can use it, especially the couple of million young engineers coming out of school in India and China. And I think these examples can spread very rapidly as engineers look at it and say, boy, that's a really weird-looking way to lay out a pipe or a duct. And then they start to look at the numbers and say, good Lord, they could do that? Hey, I could do that. I could be a hero. And boy, does that make a difference.
Yeah.
So I think the ideas of integrative design can actually spread by seeing an image, just a snapshot of a better layout, and that rearranges people's mental furniture. You don't have to go back to school and learn new theory. And that's why I think this could be the missing part of the efficiency revolution so far. You know, the most of the projections say we're going to roughly double global energy efficiency over the next few decades, as we have already more than done. But really, the potential is much bigger than that. You can save about a factor two or three on primary energy across all sectors just by substituting primary renewable electricity for, you know, steam power plants and furnaces and internal combustion engines, doing electric traction and electric heat pumps. But then you can save another roughly factor five by 2060, or factor three by about 2040 on end use efficiency, the efficiency of the vehicle being propelled or the house being heated, and so on. And I think the combined efficiency of upstream conversion and downstream end use is so large, people just wouldn't believe it until they've been through the detail, which we build on hundreds of case studies. This is real practical proven stuff. It's not speculative. It's not made up. Anybody that doesn't use it is leaving a lot of money on the table.
As you think back to, you know, when, you know, as you were mentioning that transformational trucking paper in 2006 and 7 and 8 timeframe, to today and NACFI's role in that, I mean, what are a few things that you've noticed a little bit from afar that think contribute to the impact we're making?
Well, I think your confidence reports have really helped the industry and policymakers sort through a flood of products of widely varying quality and credibility. So that's a vital role, having somebody with you know, no dog in this fight. You give an objective assessment of what works and how well it works. I think your run on less is a wonderful advance in making the combined efficiency opportunities real in real world on road testing, with all the load and weather and other stuff that goes on. I think the way you pull together your various assessments of emerging technology really helps people pay attention to what's important and, again, sort out the wheat from the chaff. And I think combined, these efforts change the competitive landscape, and they help operators really pay attention. And really good drivers do produce superior performance. The spread in quality of driver proficiency and attention is really big, and it's a huge amount of money.
What's your advice to all of us wrestling through, you know, which technology for which sets of trucks and applications, and how do we do that with urgency? How would you coach all of us in doing that?
Well, I think the resources that NACFI provides are a wonderful place to start, and you should try stuff. And see what works. Choose with a lot of discernment, using those information resources and word of mouth and press reports in the industry, because there's a lot of stuff out there. It's moving incredibly fast. I happen to think the battery electric is going to win in most markets. I've followed hydrogen for a long time, and in '03 wrote what was for a long time the industry standard white paper on it. But I think it's turning out that its business case for trucking isn't very convincing unless you have an extraordinarily long haul. And there are some of those, but they're a very small part of the market. The one game changer that we're following carefully is what's called white hydrogen or gold hydrogen, which you get right out of the ground. It turns out to be a rather abundant resource, especially outside the sedimentary basin in places with volcanic rock. That's starting to become credible, and could change the economics of the hydrogen because it's available over very large areas, and it comes often with valuable co-product gases, xenon, krypton, helium, that can pretty much pay for the drilling, so the wellhead price is about zero. But above all, efficiency. Get that up from a factor of three better than fleet to a factor five or six. Even the Tesla Semi that pretty much offsets battery weight with lightweighting has a lot of lightweighting still to go. Just watch as an example what's happening in aviation. That innovation suddenly sped up by a decade. There's a plane I kicked the tires on recently that's about eight times more efficient than a typical business jet. And that's partly because electric planes, EPs, and EVs use similar technology, skills, and supply chains. So they're co-evolving. They're playing off each other, speeding each other up. And those technologies, in turn, are going to find their way into trucks.
Well, Amory, we got to wrap it up there. I really appreciate you joining us, and I do very much appreciate our friendship. So thanks, my friend.
You're most welcome. Thanks for everything you do.
Freight Efficiency with NACFI's Mike Rosenfrantz.